I'm Maggie Creech, host of Revolution Revisited. If this podcast has changed how you think about the American Revolution or just made history come alive again, I'd love your help. Leave a rating or a short review wherever you listen. It only takes a minute, and it helps us amplify Virginia's history, connecting new listeners to the past and supporting the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Thank you for being part of the story.
Welcome to Revolution Revisited, your crash course in the American Revolution. As the 250th anniversary of America's independence approaches, dive into the stories of Virginia's rebels, rule breakers, and rabble rousers who shaped a nation. This podcast is brought to you by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and made possible by William and Karen Fralin.
Welcome back to Revolution Revisited. I'm your host, Maggie Creech. For today's bonus episode, we've got something a bit different in store for you. We're excited to present a panel discussion from the 2025 Conrad M. Hall Symposium for Virginia History, held here at the museum in October 2025. In this keynote panel discussion, you'll hear from scholars about their work on Give Me Liberty, the companion publication to Virginia's official 250th commemorative exhibition, which was produced in partnership by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture and the Jamestown-Yorktown Foundation, and presented by VA 250. Moderated by Dr. Sarah McCartney, the panel includes Dr. Alan Taylor and Dr. Karen Wolf. Together, they'll explore the publication and the broader themes of liberty. Enjoy!
Good morning, everyone. My name is James Herrera Brooks, and I have the pleasure of serving as the Virginia Museum of History and Culture's Senior Director for Research and Publications. On behalf of the VMHC, I welcome you to the third annual Conrad M. Hall Symposium for Virginia History. We're, of course, grateful to all speakers, exhibitors, and attendees for making this event happen, and we're thrilled to have you with us for what promises to be an exciting, an inspiring, and thought-provoking day. This year, as the nation approaches the 250th anniversary of its founding, we gather under the powerful and enduring theme of revolutions. Whilst we place the American Revolution at the heart of our conversations today, we also embrace the many ways in which transformative change, political, social, cultural, has shaped both Virginia and the broader American story. Today, we are proud to welcome over 50 historians, educators, and public history professionals who will help us explore the breadth and depth of Virginia's revolutionary moments. From military conflict to material culture, from legal innovation to pioneering new research methods. The VMHC is proud to serve as a platform for dialogue, scholarship, and public engagement, especially at moments as meaningful as this one. To open our day, we are honored to present a keynote panel that brings together three leading scholars of the American Revolution, Drs. Alan Taylor, Karen Wolf, and Sarah McCartney, and together they will reflect on the significance of the upcoming semi-quincentennial and share insights from their contributions to the VMHC and Jamestown-Yorktown Foundation's exhibition, Give Me Liberty, Virginia and the Forging of a Nation. Dr. Alan Taylor is the Thomas Jefferson Foundation Chair Emeritus at the University of Virginia. He is the author or contributing author of more than a dozen books on colonial history, the American Revolution, and the early Republic, two of which, William Cooper's Town and The Internal Enemy, won the Pulitzer Prize for History. Dr. Karen Wolf is a professor of history and the director and librarian of the John Carter Brown Library at Brown University, where she specializes in gender, family, and politics in 18th century British America. She, too, is no stranger to Virginia, having directed the Omohundro Institute of Early American History and having served as a professor of history at the College of William and Mary. Karen is the author of Not All Wives, Women of Colonial Philadelphia, as well as her most recent work, which we were proud to have Karen come to speak on just last month, Lineage, Genealogy, and the Power of Connection in Early America.
and Dr. Sarah McCartney serves as an assistant teaching professor in the National Institute of American History and Democracy at the College of William and Mary. Her research focuses on the colonial Virginia backcountry and the role of kinship, commerce, and the material culture of the Atlantic world in this frontier region's development. Sarah has more than a decade's experience with NIAID's pre-college program and was a contributing author, along with Karen and Alan, to the VMHC's 250th publication, Give Me Liberty, Virginia and the Forging of a Nation. So thank you so much, everyone, for being a part of today's conversation. And now please join me in welcoming our keynote panel.
Yes. Thank you all. It's wonderful to be here with you today and excited to kind of have our conversation together and then get to hear from you and have some question and answer as well. As we worked on the advisory panel for the exhibit and did our essays, I think all of us think about the bicentennial in some way and kind of what was going on in 1976, what were the goals, the interests, the attention that was given to that time. So kind of to start us out for a question is to think about how our understanding of the revolution has changed since that time, perhaps personal experience in that, but also certainly as scholars, what we see as a shift in that time from 1976. We get our centuries in there to today.
First of all, it's so lovely to be in Virginia, of course. It's lovely back here at the VMHC, and it's wonderful to be with you. So I recently was talking to a group about the bicentennial, and I realized I was the only person who was alive then.
You're in good company.
I know, exactly. I was like, thank God Alan is here. So, you know, when we were talking about how to start this conversation and Sarah said she wanted to talk about the bicentennial, I thought, well, you know, I've been thinking about the bicentennial in two dimensions. One is as a kid, I was a kid, but as a kid, it was an intense experience. But as a historian, the legacy of the bicentennial has been profound. And I think those are the two dimensions that I think about a lot when we think about 2026. Like, how will it be both an experience, but also how will it carry forward a legacy? And just to be brief so that Alan can jump in here with his wisdom, I would say that as a kid, I thought about, because I was a wordy girl, I was always a wordy girl, I thought how cool the language of the Declaration was because we were constantly reading it in a lot of public forums. And it was really fun to hear that language. It's also true that as a kid who was wordy and nerdy and interested in politics, it had come after Watergate. And that was really present, that like sense of like, how can we think about democracy and what does democratic government really mean? And what do these words mean in our context now? Even for a kid who was in elementary school, that felt profound. But equally so, we painted fire hydrants in my neighborhood, red, white, and blue. And that felt very like transgressive and cool and like a kind of patriotic revolutionary era thing to do. And we wove crepe paper through our bikes and we had the parade of all July 4th parades. So it felt like this deep experience. As a scholar, though, what I experienced was the legacy of commitment to broadening the story of American history, particularly early American history, which I'm so passionately committed to, and the source material in particular, the long and deep investment in creating expanded access to sources. And I hope we'll talk more about that, but I think about like documentary editions of founders' papers and also other extended materials which have been used to expand that American story that began in anticipation and then followed on from the bicentennial. So those are just some kind of first blush thoughts that I hope we can like pick up and maybe return to.
Yeah, I'll pick up on a point that Karen made. It was much more of a common culture, public culture, I think, than it is today. There were the three networks in PBS, no cable TV, no social media. So there was more of a common culture. And so at the public level, I think there was more commonality to the celebration than I think we're going to see in the next year in this country now. at the scholarly level, there was a divide that was very much between historians who were emphasizing a consensus approach and were looking at political elites and were looking at the great political decisions versus more progressive historians who were interested in class conflict. But it was class conflict entirely imagined within the white race among free people. And so my notion of the academic history there is that whereas the public history was more of a commonality, the academic history was more divided along this actually fairly limited spectrum of the people involved in the revolution. There wasn't that much attention to women. They were a sidebar. There wasn't that much attention paid to African Americans. They were a sidebar. And almost no attention was paid to Native Americans, also a very small sidebar at that time. And so what I think has really changed since then is that issues of race and gender have become much more at the center of the academic story. And one of the paradoxes is I think that by and large among academics, there's a greater sense of agreement as the landscape has become broader. Whereas in the public culture, I think things are much more polarized.
That's so interesting. So I wanted to go back to my point about the expansion of source material, because I think that when we think about what the public cultural representation was at the bicentennial, it's interesting to think about what the investments were that were being made beforehand. And I refer to this anecdote a lot because it feels really meaningful to me. But in the summer of 1963, President John F. Kennedy, so just months before he was killed, wrote the foreword to what would be the first volume of the documentary history of the Naval Documents of the American Revolution. I can't remember the exact title of the project. It's a fantastic project. By the way, it's just been refunded by the NEH. But Kennedy wrote in this foreword, this is 1963, he said, we need to invest in finding these materials and editing and publishing these materials and making them available because the bicentennial is coming. And the best thing we can do is to make our history more widely available. And I just love that for many reasons. One is that was 1963 and the bicentennial was 13 years away. So like, go historians and documentary editors and naval historians who were like, you know, looking out there. But also because this sense that given the technology that was available at the time, which was produce letterpress editions and try to make them available to libraries as much as possible and to circulate this information, was really an important impetus. And we saw that with other documentary edition projects like the Papers of George Washington that started in the late 1960s, and which actually all of those kinds of things, and we could go on and mention other really important projects of kind of elites and non-elites, but all of those have helped actually completely to fill out this powerful story of a kind of more complete picture of who all was there and who was participating at the time. We would not know what we know about George Washington and slavery at Mount Vernon if it weren't for the Papers of George Washington. For example, we also wouldn't know as much about Washington as a military commander. So these kinds of investments in advance have paid off since the bicentennial.
Yeah. Thinking about the essays that you wrote for the Give Me Liberty book, are there particular ways you can see that legacy of those sources that allowed kind of the scholarship you've produced there that maybe wouldn't have been in other places? Or maybe it's the reframing of the questions as well.
Well, my particular essay didn't really draw upon any of the papers of the founders and was drawing more upon memoirs by religious figures. Now, what's been the digitization of history in general is immensely helpful. It's possible for me sitting in California to go online and to read most of the published material from the 18th century, which would not have been possible in 1976.
Yeah, absolutely. And at least I like to put things in a frame. So for me, in writing an essay about how Virginia families confronted and experienced and made decisions during the revolution, there were all kinds of these kinds of legacy source availability projects that helped me to write that. For example, the National Archives and Records Administration, which has digitized the full corpus of those founders' documentary editions under, I think, the most extraordinary resource, Founders Online, which most of you know, but if you don't know, absolutely powerhouse. Every time I introduce someone to it, they're like, mind blown. But also, the National Archives has made available things like pension records for the revolution. So I was able to walk back and read through the pension records of African and African descended men who served, indigenous men who served, and the context of their family relationships at the time. And that the potency of that material, I think, really reflects that commitment to make more available and then for us to help take forward that legacy of the fuller history.
Yeah, and I'll jump in on that as well. I used a lot of the Revolutionary War pensions in my essay and having access to those. So having, I think, the framework of the scholarship coming out of the bicentennial that said, think about the little person, think about the person in the backcountry, but then to look at those sources and say, what can I understand about their lived experience in this time and place? So both benefiting from that legacy of the scholarship, but then absolutely that access to those sources. Very powerful to have those. And something that I think we can easily, I think certainly my generation can forget that that wasn't always the case. And there's a choice, yeah, to have access.
That was money. That's a lot of money.
It is. So powerful to see that. Are there other ways, thinking about the change from the bicentennial to today, other ways that you think of your essays being unique to this moment now or how they represent maybe the shift from the bicentennial or kind of this attention today?
Yeah. As I was thinking about what we would talk about today, I was thinking about how to talk about what is the history of the American Revolution. And, you know, I think that it is so inherent, it is so encoded in our processes to try to create narratives that are chronologically arranged that history itself makes it very hard sometimes for us to explore, teach, talk about and write about some of the things that were most important to people. So I'm really interested in the history of family. I'm interested in how families experienced the war, how families made decisions about their political commitments, how they managed resources during this crisis, but also how families were essential to mobilizing the forward motion of revolutionary or counter-revolutionary political ideas or to arranging government. But family is not a subject that history has made it easy to recognize. It's a lot easier to recognize things like economy or politics or other kinds of institutionally framed things. Family is a little more opaque to us with our typical tools and the long legacy of the histories that we have inherited. So I think that what's happened by including more women in the story, for example, at first in the margins, and then saying, wait a minute, these women had political ideas, they took political actions. Nope, they weren't on the floor of Congress like casting votes, but they had thoughts and ideas and commitments just like we do now. Maybe we can bring all of the people back into the fuller story. I think that's been immensely powerful. Just that general move has allowed us to write differently, to see things differently. And maybe it invites all of us to see these stories differently.
Before I worked on Virginia, I did a lot of work on New England. And I've been struck by the cultural differences between the two regions. New England, much denser populations, smaller farms, people live closer together, a denser array of institutions, particularly town institutions, which didn't much exist in Virginia, which was county-based, and people lived much more dispersed. And so there was much fewer newspapers, you know, no newspapers outside of Williamsburg in the run-up to the revolution, and very few political meetings outside of a cluster of towns. And people's public life was much more restricted, and where you would find it is in religion. I think that in the past, if we go back to 1976, there's not much attention there in the scholarship then to the role of religion in American life. There's the old Alexander Hamilton apocryphal story. They asked him why it's not in the Constitution, and he said, because we forgot. And, you know, the historians were like that in the 1970s. They just thought religious history, that's something that went on in religious studies programs. It wasn't something that historians did. And I think we still have a lag there, so that if you really want to understand the popular experience of very large numbers of people, particularly in the South, you can't do it without looking at the religious culture. And that's what I was trying to do in my essay.
Absolutely. Thinking about kind of all this scholarship, but also this public-facing work and museums and exhibits that are developing, what is the importance of seeing both those elements when we look at 2026 and beyond, that it's not just in the scholarly silo, but it's reaching out, it's looking at public initiatives, Virginia 250, you're thinking of all the programming that is developed around that. And how do we see that as connecting to this moment and the importance of this moment?
Can we rant a little? I think there are some caricatures that have, I'm not sure who they serve exactly, but there are some caricatures that have developed around history and around academia. Well, I could go off there. But anyway, one of them is that academics work within silos and keep their work within these silos and don't engage in kind of public-facing work. And, you know, at least in my experience, and I've been around a while, that's not really true, that there is a lot of public-facing work that academics do, and a lot of it that's available publicly, and that people feel a kind of urgency to share their work. And we might say that that's maybe a move of maybe the last 10 years with the advent of like online peer-reviewed blogs, for example. There's some fantastic blogs like Commonplace that's published by the Omohundro Institute, or Age of Revolutions. It's a fantastic one. And these are all just like publicly available, and you can kind of Google them and you can find great information. But that's just one example. But if we return to the era of the bicentennial, I think about my predecessor at the Omohundro, Ron Hoffman, a great historian of the American Revolution in the South. He got a fantastic grant from the Capital Historical Society, and Congress committed funding to a series of conferences on different subjects from 1976 through about 1983, a whole variety of different subjects, kind of trying to galvanize, like, what was the current scholarly research on this subject? And then the University of Virginia published the volumes, and they were volumes like on religion and the revolution. There wasn't a lot, it's true. Women and the revolution, there wasn't a lot, it's true. But it was like a kind of state of the field kind of thing. And then Ron and another great historian, Ira Berlin, both of them sadly passed away, and some other folks committed to this project. And these conferences were for public and for congressional staff and congresspeople. And I went to a couple of them. I was a young person. And they were really energizing. And those volumes were really terrific. And it was a kind of public commitment, a kind of pay forward moment. So I think there has been a long commitment of scholars to, yes, do the close, detailed expert work that's really necessary. It's kind of seed corn for a lot of what we then do publicly, but also to take that out to the public. Sure, there are introverts among us who would prefer not. But I do think that the engagement of scholarly research and folks who are doing research in public-facing institutions like this one, look at what's happening right here. You know, it's amazing, right? I think that that has been generative for a long time, and I see that as a real legacy in kind of structurally from the period of the bicentennial. I don't know. What do you think?
Well, I don't think you can have three historians without having four different views being expressed. So I'm going to dissent just a bit from what Karen said. So she's a glass half full person, and I'm a glass half empty.
That is so true.
Yeah. And Karen, she is a real leader in outreach. And so I think she sees more of that than I see. I think there is a lot going on, but I would argue there needs to be a lot more going on, and that there are a lot of academics. who, for understandable reasons, because the academy is set up to oblige you to focus on your peers, and you are under pressure to get tenure and publish things. So I understand why there's an inwardness that has developed, and I mean it being in history departments. I do think those Capital Historical Society things were absolutely wonderful, but I'm not sure how broadly available they became. And they're also, they were from an era where the federal government was investing in things like that. The federal government doesn't invest in that. Instead, we have military parades. So it means there's more responsibility in local institutions like this one to do the sort of work that the federal government used to try to do, but which will not do anymore. So I would just say that Karen has laid out the best case scenario, but I think we all have a lot more work to do before we will be close to what we should do in bringing history to more Americans, because most Americans, in fact, know almost nothing about the Revolutionary Era.
Yeah. Well, I think of my own work, and as someone who grew up reading your scholarship as a young scholar, thinking about the interplay between these realms and how that inspiration for that next generation scholar, all of us teachers also, but sometimes comes from the classroom, but often comes from that museum experience or that remembering the fire hydrants painting, and how those connect in a way that it inspires that next generation. And when I think about working with students and it's that visit to the museum, or that's that thing that sparked that interest to them that then leads them into the scholarship and co. So I think of that relationship between those worlds. And I don't know, maybe I'll be the third opinion then, thinking that as people look at those elements, it feels a little more visible, perhaps, than it might be. I feel like I understand the connection between the scholarly and the public in a way in the last decade or so that I'm not sure I was aware of. Maybe it was just as a kid. So maybe historians are making visible a little more the work they're doing that is public-facing, and maybe the digital component has allowed that you see that blog post or you see that tagline somewhere that didn't require digging into a library catalog. So I think that's my kind of additional, if we have a fourth opinion somewhere. But yeah, absolutely seeing the connection between these, and more to do, but development since the bicentennial for sure. Yeah. In that moment, you're thinking about what we hope people take away from this moment, the semi-quincentennial, the scholarship, the exhibitions, the programming. Do you have a goal that you hope people take away from your legacy, the scholarship that you're building up, thinking about impacts, but also as a nation, as a state, hopes for impacts of this moment?
My hope is, and I think the exhibit here has done a wonderful job with that. And I'm also going to do a pitch for the Ken Burns film that's going to come out November 16th. It's 12 hours. It's not all on one night. Don't worry. It's over 6 nights, but it's absolutely wonderful, despite my being in it. There are really some great historians who are in it, and just wonderful voices. And the whole thing is just extraordinary, I think. And what the commonality between the exhibit here and the Ken Burns film is, there's an attempt to say, you know, the revolution involved everybody who lived here. Right. It wasn't just a set of leaders, as important as they are. And those leaders and their importance comes through, I think, very clearly, both in the exhibit here and then also. But there is an attempt, a very serious attempt, to say, let's seriously think about everybody who was involved in the revolution, who was affected by the revolution. And that requires harder work because most of them are not well documented. It's that hard work that we need to do.
I think many of us are anticipating that documentary, and some of us have had the pleasure of already seeing Ken and seeing some of the material. We're about to welcome him to Providence and to Brown in a couple of weeks, and I'm only on hour 6. You're very good, though. You're not wearing your glasses. That was my first thought.
They made me take them off.
Reflection.
For the glam shots. Anyway, it is really good. And there's one thing I really appreciate, I'm only on hour 6, is the broad context, particularly of Indigenous America, that you see the British-American context taking place within a continent that is fundamentally, profoundly indigenous. And that in places like Virginia, where 40% of people at the edge, you know, at the moment of revolution were enslaved, you have that tense context is right at the center of the narrative. One thing that I would love to see take away, and this isn't Ken Burns' project, but I think it is historians' project, is to maybe elevate some of what you refer to as the hard work, which is, I think that exposing the scaffolding of history is really important, not just so people know it's hard. It is actually pretty hard sometimes. It's really fun too, but it is hard sometimes to work for weeks and months and only find a few little scraps of the remaining story of what you know is a full and robust past, and to try to contextualize from the limited source material that remains. But it is really important that we expose that scaffolding, I think, in part because history is not the past. The past is like, we can't even recover what we did 10 minutes ago here, but history is what we understand about the past. And what we understand the past is highly dependent on the materials that are available to us to analyze it and comprehend it and then share it, and then the means by which we do that comprehending and sharing. And the more we are transparent about that, then we're not so much shocking people with, why is this all new? Why did I never know that before? It's because we really are like learning new things. We really do have more material available, and we do have new perspectives, and we're able to flesh out stories differently. And I think that is an enormously empowering in a democratic society to say, yes, this is the process by which we come to understanding that. So that's my hope. And, you know, I'm a nerdy historian, so I, of course, I'm going to think everybody's going to care about this process stuff. But I hope people get an opportunity to think about that and to encounter that process and to appreciate what that process really means for all of us.
Well, let me just, to agree with Karen, I mean, people actually are interested in the process. They are interested. How did you find that out? The kind of detective story of figuring things out is, I think, of more interest often than the conclusions we might reach.
Yes, I think that's true. I think that's true. And it's the archival work in a library like up there, you know, when you're hunting for something and you locate something and you read something and all of a sudden the light bulb goes off and you realize you've seen two other things like that somewhere, and you go back to your notes and a picture sometime comes to you. So it's the hunt for the item. And thank you to librarians and archivists who catalog things and preserve things and make it available for a historian to have that light bulb moment and facilitate our understanding. But then also then what you do with it, the other pieces that you have that you can put it into place with. And there are ways of writing history, right? And I'm always going to be like, I want the footnotes because I want to know where you got that. I want to know how you came to that conclusion. I want to read where it is that that came from. I not that I'm a suspicious person, but I just like,
curious.
There we go. Yeah. Just like, show your work. You know, I feel that about everything. Show your work. But I think that there is something to the kind of engagement between the thing that you're telling us about and where you got it from that is a key piece of public engagement with history.
Let me just give a quick editorial on top of that. We talked about the wonders of digital sources, and they are wonderful. But I often encounter students who now think they can do their research entirely on their computer, and they don't go to archives. And if they do go to archives, they discover that there's handwriting.
Not just transcriptions.
And, you know, they've never studied penmanship. You know, Karen and I studied penmanship. We're of that generation, right? And I cannot emphasize too much, as Karen has just emphasized, the importance of institutions like the archive here. I end up doing research in them. I fear that some younger scholars don't understand that importance.
Well, if I could make a plug also for another local institution, the Library of Virginia, which has been doing so much amazing work. Like, I follow it like such a fangirl on Instagram. I'm like, oh, it's a new set of sources that they've uncovered and are making available. And I think there are ways that institutions, like, I think the Library of Virginia does a good job of showing you, we got this material, like these county court records, we've digitized them. Now we've made them available and sort of they're searchable. And sometimes they're not because we don't have the resources to put in the metadata to make it searchable, but you can look through it. And I think the more that institutions do that kind of thing, telling us what's available online and what's not, giving us their process, I think that really helps with exactly this problem of thinking that you can just find it all online. Because of course, we also know that anything that's digitized is digitized because there were resources to do it. And that means somebody made it a priority over something else.
Well, I'll put in a plug for the power of the digitized world. I'm working with students on a transcription project, but we're also making a trip to the special collections to see the physical account books because we're also studying material culture and thinking of these objects as a witnessing object. So a plug for the rest of the museum, all of the material culture that we have to help us understand the lives of people in the past. So they're having to decipher some handwriting, which is a new experience. I think it will benefit them for their whole lives to be able to read their grandparents' cards in cursive, but to not forget that visit to the archive as well, to see the object and to interact with the incredible archival staff and museum staff who have such deep knowledge of places as well. So I love the idea of making it more visible, but also remembering that that screen is not going to give you everything. Going in person is still powerful.
Totally. That's so true for books too. I mean, at the library that I run, we've got a commitment to 100% digitization of our library by 2034 and like 28% there. But we try to, and I don't think we're doing a good enough job yet, explain on the digital platform that the digitized object can do things that the physical object cannot, that you can do things with it. You can analyze it in certain ways. And the same is true for the physical object. And it's not just because 18th century books smell good, which they do, but because there are things that you know about how the book falls, who read it, about not just the marginal comments that someone made, but really like the weight of someone's arm or something else on keeping a certain page open. There are just so many, or how the book is bound or rebound. There are just so many things that the physical object tells us that we can't even explain. Our brains are so complex that there is no amount of AI that can study that and give us that information. Not to mention that it's just way more rewarding to do it yourself.
Well, and a plug for that, when we think about the physical object, we have wonderful resources, like particularly in Virginia. I think of Colonial Williamsburg's trades interpreters, historians there who understand how the book is made. So to take that, to say, I see the physical object, how does it fall? How do I understand it? But how do you even put this together? What kind of skill does it take?
So that's the biology of its making.
Yes. So that's another area where this kind of the scholarly and the public perhaps combine in a way that is inspirational to people. Another place to visit, another place to research, and another group of people to certainly talk to about their work.
I'm Maggie Creech, host of Revolution Revisited. If this podcast has changed how you think about the American Revolution or just made history come alive again, I'd love your help. Leave a rating or a short review wherever you listen. It only takes a minute, and it helps us amplify Virginia's history, connecting new listeners to the past and supporting the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Thank you for being part of the story.
For 250 years, Virginia's story has been shaped by people from many places and the traditions, ideas, and dreams they've brought with them. We the People, a new exhibition at the Virginia Museum of History and Culture, explores the stories of achievement and resilience and communities of those who have immigrated to the Commonwealth. Learn more and get tickets at virginiahistory.org/we the people.
Well, we have some time for Q&A unless we have some final thoughts.
Well, I would just remind, this is somewhat off. I once had occasion to go to the book bindery at Windsor Castle.
Hey, I've been there.
And well, you may have noticed this. There was a stapler there and it said the Queen's. And I know this is when the Queen was still alive. And I just couldn't imagine her going down there and actually working with a stapler.
I was thinking about the book press, which they said had been in, you know, had been used since the Stuarts. It was unbelievable. Like if you've been in the book press and, you know, been in the bindery and you see like these book presses are like, they're just big pounders, basically. And they're like, well, why would you not use it? It's great. It works, you know, hundreds of years of book making. Anyway, you can see how quickly we get off track here.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
On the go off.
It is. It is. We do have time for questions and answers, or we'll try and answer your questions.
So I know that some of you are professors, I think, but you mentioned AI earlier in the process of learning that industry. So whether it work with your students or otherwise, how do you think that AI can benefit that process?
Well, I think there are many ways of thinking about AI, and there are many different AIs, as it were. All of them share a common thing, which is it's basically an aggregating process and then a mean finding process. And so if you're working with a large language model, for example, which is culling from, you know, all the known websites in the world, and you ask it a basic factual question, it often comes up with the wrong one because it will give you, you know, the median of whatever the world thinks about a topic. But there are also, I think, ways that AI has proved useful for scholars, like in transcription projects, when you can actually train the model to read that manuscript hand. I still think a human reading is a great resource, but the truth is we can rarely galvanize enough human brains on transcription for the kind of transcription work that we want to have available. So I think there are lots of such different applications for AI in history. I guess the thing that is most worrying to me is in a world of profusion of compiled images and texts that people will have a hard time figuring out what we were talking about before. Show your work. Where does that come from? What's the source for that? And may become totally disenchanted with their ability to know that very thing. I think, you know, responsible AI in any context should be able to show its work. It should be able to cite its sources. And I know there are forthcoming projects that do just that, that give you a sense of this information is drawn from this source, this source, this source. But that should be true for history aggregation as well. I would hope that what students most want to do is to do the work themselves, because it is so immensely rewarding, and I don't think we can underestimate the value just to our own sense of well-being and community to explore this stuff ourselves rather than to ask the machine to produce information for us. Brain joy is a real thing, and it is really a part, even when you're studying the hardest history, when the brain is working hard at trying to understand. It's deeply rewarding.
I really have nothing constructive to say about AI.
I'm not sure I have a lot either. I've actually been pleased in transcription projects when students have come back and said, AI can't do it. Or they've said, isn't it defeating the purpose if this thing does it for me? And I've talked about the importance of proximity to sources, that getting in and reading it, some of what we just said, of getting in and reading it and understanding it. One means you can check it, which is necessary, but it gives you an understanding that you just are not going to get from the kind of cursory look if AI transcribes something for you. So I've been maybe more like that. I'm pleased when someone comes back and says, it couldn't do it, and I don't want it to because I want to do the work. And I'm like, oh, yay. That's good.
Thank you for that great question, though.
Yes.
You talked about the enormously enriching impact of knowing more about families, about women, Native Americans, minorities, different classes of people. I wonder, do you find, is it an issue with your students? Did they lose track of the kind of the underlying story of what made America in the first place, the economic opportunity, land ownership, maybe even opportunities for social progress, which were unknown in the old world? How do you keep that from getting lost in the focus on the peripheral participants?
Thank you for that question, because I think that question lurks a lot and people don't always ask it straightforwardly. So thank you. I think one, it's always useful to elevate what each of us thinks is the underlying story. I happen to agree with almost all of what you said about the underlying story, but I think there would be other interpretations of what the underlying story is. And in the case of the one that you and I are mostly in agreement about, I think what's really valuable is showing how many people contributed to exactly that story. So women's labor, for example, in producing a really robust economy from the 17th century forward is totally plain. You don't get that economy without women's labor in all kinds of different dimensions. You actually don't get that economy without the Atlantic slave trade. That's the reality of that economic engine. And it's useful to talk about all of these dimensions of that underlying story. If one of our challenges is thinking about what makes us feel positive and uplifted as we go forward, and here I am just going to call on another of Alan's colleagues who's in Ken Burns's piece, Jane Kamensky, the president at Monticello and an outstanding historian. Jane wrote a piece some time ago worrying that if we, and by that she meant academic historians, were exploring the kind of the dark violence of the 18th century, would we leave students with enough to feel hopeful and positive about? And I think that's a really important thing to address too. For myself, yes, I'm a glass half full person. That's just true. But also, I think that the real hard history is better equipment for us moving forward. I think it helps us think about, oh, things can feel really hard. Many generations have felt that things were really hard, and positive things can come out of a really tough set of circumstances. I feel that a civic contribution actually towards, I think, what is really the greatest of the American story, liberty for all, is recognizing that fullest story and understanding the platform on which we're building and which we're trying to leverage up to liberty and equality for all. So thank you a lot for that question. Alan, did you want to talk?
Yeah, that is a great question. When I was going to school, what you're calling the underlying question or issue was the only thing that was taught. And I have found it very enriching to broaden the story out and to think about the whole cast of people, not all of whom benefited from social mobility. So I think the goal of all good historians is to try to tell a holistic story in which we are trying to understand the range of experiences in early America. And it's tough to do. You're right that sometimes it can seem like a zero-sum game, that if you're paying more attention to people who were previously thought of as on the margins of the underlying story, it seems like you're not paying enough attention to this underlying story. I think there's one story in American history with a cast of millions of people participating in it and a diverse range of experiences within there, and we're trying to be honest about it all.
I think that's the whole glass, Alan. You just did the whole thing.
Didn't say we were there yet.
Well, and I'll just add to that. It expands at times. I think when I teach courses, as I regularly do about kind of the revolution, it gets broader sometimes of how many days of class, how many weeks, because of all the different groups that I'm wanting students to think about. But what we end up with is the nuance and the fuller picture, which I find students respond to well, because they're saying, you know, is there more than maybe the political history? There's more than that. What about the person in this place or the person of this experience? It is a challenge, though, to balance more at times.
All the research study all I've done, I just long to sit here. You know, most people know the common name when it comes to revolution, Diana Vale. Did y'all discover any characters or people that were kind of unique that just really intrigued you that you thought, you didn't know it's sort of this person before it made a difference, or it intrigued you?
Well, the character that I feature in my essay is Devereux Jarrett. And I thought I knew Devereux Jarrett primarily from reading his appearance in Rhys Isaacs' book. And in a number of other books, there's the famous quote about how intimidated he was by the Virginia gentry of the 18th century. And that's a sincere feeling that he had. What I didn't know, and which I came to know as I read his later writings, is that after the revolution, he missed those guys. He felt that society had become so competitive and individualistic as a result of the revolution that it had lost the kind of sense of community that he had come to think was maintained by a social hierarchy. I'm not embracing either the early or the late Devereux-Jarrett as a view of society, but what I'm saying is here's a guy who experienced the revolution and is a real, I think, litmus of the changes the revolution did make in the overall culture of society, that people experienced it as an increase of individualism, of having free choice. But this is, many people experience this as this was kind of alarming. And we can sometimes lose sight of those people who felt they were alarmed by how competitive and individualistic society became during that generation.
Yeah, I would say that there's so many not always untold, but lesser known stories of the revolution that are really revealing. And just one of the ones that I wrote about is something that I've been thinking about for a long time, which is the Quaker exiles from Philadelphia. And, you know, that's a story that's quite illuminating, I think, of a kind of paranoia. So what happens is in Philadelphia, the Quakers, who had long been in power, kind of wealthy and politically prominent, but who also were pacifists and wouldn't take a pro-patriot or actually even a pro-British stand during the revolution. And the patriots, once they were holding the city in the fall of 1777, they took dozens of Quaker men. There was a whole, actually, there's an amazing story about how there's like a fake thing that was this, called the, no kidding, the Spanktown Papers. Who would call that that? Anyway, this thing called the Spanktown Papers that was reputed to reveal how Quakers in Philadelphia were giving away Patriot military locations. And, you know, anyway, they were such a danger to society and certainly to the Patriot cause. Anyway, dozens of Quaker gentlemen were rounded up and sent out of Philadelphia, and they were sent to Virginia for months, about 6 months. And a couple of them really suffered. One died while there. And I wrote about it because people who write about Philadelphia know a bit about this story. There's been a little bit more attention to it recently. But I was interested in the Virginia side of it. When they get to Virginia, they're in Winchester. And it's very interesting to see what the Quaker meeting is doing and how they're managing this influx of people in the midst of war. You have to feed them. You have to house them. In theory, some of these are very wealthy, prominent people. They want to like treat them nicely, but honestly, it's really hard. I thought that that's such a revealing episode because of the differential impact in Philadelphia, their families left behind, and pretty hysterical, but ultimately successfully petitioned for their return, and the impact on these communities in Virginia that are trying to deal with them. But what prompts it is this sense of mutual suspicion and really paranoia and kind of conspiracy thinking, including nobody has really ever successfully shown who created the Spanktown Papers. John Adams was totally convinced by it, though. Anyway, but so I think that's like a great example of an episode that we can dig deeper into and that reveals interesting patterns.
Yeah, when I'd say in my research, I see a lot of people just at the cusp before the revolution really begins. And I do a lot with account books. So there's one mention of someone, there's one name. And so thinking about how their life then carries forward. So I'm not able to put together a whole life story for them, but I'm intrigued by the snapshot of them. And then thinking of what do they do during the revolution then? Women who are widowed, how are they providing for family in the backcountry region of what's present day West Virginia? The men who are having shooting competitions as a way of proving their marksmanship. There's little snapshots of something that then kind of colors and brings to life everything that happens during the revolution to be like, that's that person, that very curious, interesting, quirky person is also in this revolutionary moment. So that's what I enjoy seeing.
In terms of the basic aspect of your work, you speak your experience of being academic advisors and the Giving Liberty exhibit and how that interplay works between the advisors.
Why are you asking this question?
Reveal yourself
plant.
Here.
He's a plant.
Co-curator of the exhibit. So, I mean, I've had the honor of serving as an advisor on a bunch of different kinds of projects, including a previous Ken Burns film. And it's always an interesting assignment because I think, and I'll be interested to hear what you all think of this, But my sense is what you're always trying to do is offer perspective and actionable possible resolutions and solutions and content. So it doesn't help to say, well, I don't like that or that won't work. It's, you know, what you really want to do is say, but what about that? And what about this thing? This could underpin that. I would say that one of the most exciting pieces of it, though, is that you're working collaboratively. Often as scholars, and this is totally true for me, and I know, you know, whatever your professional location is, it's true for many of us. It's really lovely when you're just like in your own head in a, you know, in a library or in front of your screen or wherever. But working collaboratively is also incredibly rewarding, and working collaboratively in this kind of context, knowing that the outcome is going to be something like this exhibit, which will be seen by so many people and have such an important role to play in an important moment, is just really, really rewarding. And I'm just really grateful for it.
It's been important to me, as it has been to Karen, to try to reach a broader public. But it turns out an academic book is not the best way to do that, which is what we write. Now, we hope that more people would read academic books, but the reality is there's some multiplier number which will actually come and see your exhibit here beyond who will read our books. So working with museum specialists and filmmakers is an opportunity for us to work with them. They're not going to do exactly, you know, what we do in an academic book. And as Karen pointed out, we have to help the experts in their own field problem solve within their own field rather than just to do what we might want them to do. And if you approach it in that spirit as the academic, you actually learn a ton. So I've always found it wonderfully enriching to work with people who are really good at conveying history in other forums with other materials than the ones I work with.
Well, and I loved one of our, I think our early conversations with the group was, I think if all the academics, there would be three rooms before you even get to the beginning of the exhibit, because we were like, more backstory, more context. So that was a fascinating discussion to have of, you know, that introduction, that prologue where you say, let me give you the background for what I'm doing. And there is a plaque in there when you go to Give You Liberty, make sure you take a look at the backstory that's there. So it's fascinating to see kind of what the academics want versus that reality of what can actually fit in this space. I spend a lot of time in museums with students. A lot of the courses I do are place-based, museum-based courses. So we talk a lot about what we get out of a museum in space. So I loved the opportunity to be on the other side and think about what goes into it, the effort of so many names that are listed and so many names that aren't listed. So wonderful work all around by the whole team.
My question, I'm going to try and draw on a couple of different threads. I'm a public school history teacher. And so it does sometimes feel like a zero-sum game to me, because I have 6 weeks to get from, hey, this is my name and this is our class, to the test on the American Revolution. And it can be hard to give them the sort of shared cultural baseline story and also make sure that you're finding ways to highlight the experiences of all of the actors. But this is my first year teaching U.S. history in a little bit. And something that I noticed this year is I went into my class sort of assuming my students would know the shared baseline story, and they don't. There's a real lack of... And I think about your story about, like, painting fire hydrants. My kids would paint fire hydrants. They don't feel that sense of belonging to the story. And I wonder if that's the case. Are we losing something that's important? Is there a danger to what we're losing, that sense of shared belonging to a shared story that unites our society? Have we lost the plot? Was it out of plot? Like, is this... I was thinking too about your comment about the division, right? crave is to get this kind of three networks sort of shared culture among them. It's just, it seems like it's gone.
I mean, I'm a historian of the 18th century, not the 20th or goodness knows the 21st century. But I do think that it is, so just to say about the kind of the shared story, I've been teaching for a really long time. And when I first started teaching decades ago, I used to think that what I would do is disrupt the traditional narrative. But my students didn't know the traditional narrative, so there was no disrupting. I was like, and they were like, what? So I also think that it's really tempting to think that those three networks represented a true shared cultural experience when I think they were a veneer, but there were lots and lots of communities that never shared that kind of cultural perspective, that in other words, there's been so much fragmentation for so long that the narrative that we were all united and now we're not, that kind of declension narrative, I think is beguiling, but can be distracting. True, technology, there are real things that social media is doing, and we know that, like the research is good on that point, that it is heightening public expressions of sharp divergence among the small number of super users on social media. That's all it's doing, is super users on social media are being driven to polarity. You know, I hear this all the time when you go back and actually talk to people in your town or your community or your whatever. It doesn't look quite like that. So I feel like there's both a danger of overemphasizing some kind of unity or shared perspective, and maybe even a nostalgia for the idea of a shared perspective. I venture to say that there are many communities that did not share in that shared perspective and were not represented in those three networks and that PBS, which my parents was on all the time in my family, total Walter Cronkite kind of thing, you know, that's a callback, but also a danger of overestimating or overdrawing public expressions of division now. I mean, there are certain markers of that, but again, I'm
half. You are so half full.
I know. Got to work from something.
Yes. I actually enjoy optimists.
Makes us sound like some kind of domestic pet, you know? Like,
they're such wonderful people. So I'll just kind of caricature the traditional narrative that I grew up going to school, which was that Americans were united against the British and they were under the inspirational leadership of the founding fathers, who basically solved all our political problems by creating the perfect constitution. I work a lot with K-12 teachers in various formats. If you were to try to teach that today to your students, at best case scenario is their eyes would glaze over, right? They'd say, that seems completely unreal to me, right? But I do think there is a common ground. It's not that narrative. What a lot of our issues today come down to is citizenship. Who is a citizen? What does it mean to be a citizen? What are the responsibilities of a citizen? And linked to that is, who gets excluded as a citizen, right? All of the issues we're having about immigration now, the people who you're teaching in school are a lot more diverse than the people who went to my rural Maine high school in the early 1970s. So we need to speak to the students that are in our classrooms who are, I think, potentially interested in our political institutions and how they operate and how they will affect them, and are potentially interested in what are the sources of that. So I think if we kind of keep that at the center of the story, you know, what is a republic? Why did people struggle and die and kill to create a republic? How is it that that republic didn't serve the interests of everybody that time? How is it that over time people have struggled to broaden the definition of our republic in order to include more people and to extend rights to more people? And where are we at today? I think if that's at the center of your teaching, that you will do, you know, you'll reach a lot of students and it will engage them.
Sounded very glass half full.
Call me an optimist.
Looking forward to 2026, and to be candid, the official version of the revolution is not likely to be as diverse and inclusive as we've been talking about here today.
Well, whose official version are we talking about? Who is going to be the great keeper of this?
Well, the current administration will.
Okay, they don't speak for me, right?
I mean, I think that the political questions are all around us, and they're really uncomfortable because if there are a lot of caricatures about academic scholars staying inside their silos, I also think there's a lot of thinking about how maybe we are all in kind of two separate camps when I think that many of us are in a lot more of a muddy middle. So these political questions which make us choose are really unsettling, especially at a moment when we are supposed to be thinking about the kind of foundations of a country and a government that has this aspiration to be inclusive. I do think it's deeply unfortunate that the White House has chosen to advance, for example, literally on the White House website, some historical materials which don't show their work and which are not grounded in the most expert public or academic work. I think that's really unfortunate. I think that's the most I would say about that. That's how I'm going to continue to feel about it. That's unfortunate. It is not a service to us. And I think we go forward and do the work that we know has the integrity of the professional discipline of historians working in all kinds of different professional circumstances.
Given that there are so many different themes and threads in American revolutionary history that you've discussed, what are some particular themes or threads that you think would be really, really relevant for people to advance about religion, or the international revolution, right, or the indigenous revolution? What are the particular threads in your view that this moment that you should work hard to make sure are part of our teaching, in my case, or public history?
I'm a native of Virginia. I worked in Virginia for a long time, and I've lived in Rhode Island now for 4 years. Love Rhode Island, but I also love Virginia. And we're here in part to think about the Virginia story and what Virginia brings to 2026. I think Virginia, you know, no disrespect to some other places that might think they have a view on this, Massachusetts or Pennsylvania. But I think Virginia is the place that has actually the greatest opportunity and is seizing that opportunity to encourage us to engage with the biggest questions. And I say that because in Virginia, 40% of people on the verge of the period of revolution were enslaved. And Virginia contributed 4 of the first 5 presidents to the United States. There is no place where that conjunction between freedom and unfreedom is more remarkable or pointed than in Virginia, and where we can most directly talk about the tensions and the possibilities and the divergences between what patriots were advocating, patriot leadership for themselves, and how people then came to hold them to it, sometimes not in their lifetime, sometimes in their lifetime. So I feel like that story of freedom and unfreedom in Virginia, as it is professed by founding leaders and as it was experienced by enslaved people taking action, making decisions, sometimes making choices, absolutely, for a different form of political structure, saying, I'm going to stay with the British because they actually are offering freedom from enslavement. I think that that's, to me, that's an incredibly important story that Virginia offers here. And obviously, that's represented here in a bit.
I think you identified many themes that people could continue to explore. And I want to pick up on a couple of other questions just to go back to Warren's very good question. I think a lot more people will see the Ken Burns film than will go to the White House website. So when you say, what's the official story of the revolution going to be? I'm not sure there is an official story of the revolution, but if there is one that will reach more Americans, it's going to be the more inclusive one that the exhibit here and that Ken Burns is putting out. And then to go to the question, which was about the underlying story and about land, I think land really is something that we should think about. We live in a much more urbanized society. I often ask my students, how many of you grew up in farm families? Ordinarily, none of them, maybe one or two in a group of 100 might say so. You wouldn't say that in the 18th century. You know, very few people went to university in the 18th century, but almost everybody lived off the land in some way. That doesn't mean they're subsistence farmers, because they weren't. But the relationship with the land underlies their relationship with other people. The fact that native peoples are losing land is very much connected to the expanding opportunity of many other people, which is entirely at that time based on getting access to farmland. So telling the story of the land, the environmental impact of settlement on the land, and the kinds of relationships between different groups who value the same land but value it for different cultural reasons, different economic reasons, is, I think, another way to give a center to the story.
Okay, there's time for one more question.
I know we've talked a little bit about public history today, and we have so many great organizations that are here today that are, for lack of a better word, I mean this with excitement, making a big deal out of 250 years. Mm-hmm. What do you think is the importance of the public engaging with those events and celebrating 250 years?
Well, for myself, I tend to use the word commemoration rather than celebration, just because I think we're marking 250, and we're thinking about what does 250 mean? What did circa 1776 mean? What does it mean to us now? I think it's a huge opportunity. I mean, I feel like I don't think there's anybody in this room who doesn't believe that 2026 is an extraordinary kind of once in a moment opportunity to engage with the historical past. Actually, the White House thinks that too, and that's why they're doing what they're doing. History is the platform on which we stand. And history, not the past, but history, how we understand it, is the platform on which we stand and on which we build towards the future. So I think it's enormously important. In my new home state of Rhode Island, there are 400. Rhode Island is very small, for anybody who doesn't know. So beautiful. It's so watery. But there are 400 public history organizations in Rhode Island. And I love the energy of public history, just really engaging this opportunity. It's hard and it's tiring, and the resources of time and money are not flowing. But I think we can't overestimate how important it is.
I think Karen made an important distinction between celebrate and commemorate. I think we have to, being glass half full, I mean, glass half empty, that's my job. There are going to be a lot of Americans that just want it to be celebration. And that's fine up to a point, until they want to say, we don't want to hear anything that's not celebration. I'll flip back and forth between half full and half empty. History matters enormously to our sense of who we are and what we should do and what we can do. And for that very reason, it's always going to be contested. So you can't go forth and think that we're going to present something and it's just the past and it's not going to have pushback on it. There's always going to be somebody who wants a different story than the one we're telling. That's okay. That's democracy. But it's also the reality that there are all sorts of varieties of history other than the academic one. We are swimming in that broader sea with many cross currents, and just to be aware of that.
Yeah, that's a wonderful kind of concluding thoughts. Going back to Warren's comment, thinking about the narrative, and I'll say, buy the book, you know, give the Give Me Liberty book. I was thinking, we started out by talking about the outcomes of the scholarship from 1976 and the publications. And so here we have another example. See the exhibit today of the scholarship that's going to be going forward. I'm excited to have seen the number of my students who have bought the book. They're probably a little biased for why they purchased it. But, you know, there's another generation that will be the next generation that's being impacted by this work that's being done for 2026. So I think that's exciting to see.
We hope you enjoyed today's bonus episode, and we hope to see you in person at the 2026 Conrad M. Hall Symposium for Virginia History at the museum this fall. To purchase a copy of the book, visit shopvirginiahistory.org. To learn more about the annual Symposium for Virginia History, visit virginiahistory.org/symposium. As always, thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Thanks for listening to Revolution Revisited. The American Revolution was not an ending, but a beginning. The stories continue to unfold. Subscribe now and catch the next episode for another journey through history. This podcast is made possible by William and Karen Fralin and presented by the Virginia Museum of History and Culture.
Revolution Revisited is a production of the Virginia Museum of History and Culture. Our production staff includes Haley Finner, Maggie Creech, Nicole Martorana, and Tracy Schneider. Be sure to subscribe to get notified about upcoming episodes. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
Explore 16,000 years of Virginia history. The Virginia Museum of History and Culture offers a variety of exhibitions, public programs, and special events for the whole family. Learn more and plan your visit at virginiahistory.org.